Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Parents, teachers, school board members, and administrators have been meeting regularly as school districts approach the new year with COVID-19 in mind. Is there a one-size-fits-all approach that works? How do you feel about your child going back into the classroom? Governor Kristi Noem has been opposed to checkpoints when they're being used on reservation land in the state, but are they proving to have an effect in keeping coronavirus cases down in those areas? The Dakota Political Junkies join us today to help answer some of those questions. Tom Dempster is with us today. He's a former South Dakota State Senator from District 9. Tom, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. Mighty fine to be back.
And joining our panel for the first time is another former South Dakota lawmaker. He's a senior fellow with PRISM. He's also on the board of directors for Billy Sutton's Leadership Institute. We're happy to welcome Kevin Killer from Pine Ridge. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Lori. Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you here. Let's talk about Governor Kristi Noem's press conference from yesterday, where she said essentially laid out the importance of, you know, why school matters, why in-class education matters, what's at stake if we can't figure out how to do this well. And a lot of parents and teachers have reacted to that as well with concerns as school districts make their plans. So, Tom, let's start with you. Anything from the governor's press conference about the science of going back to school, and she encouraged, not for communities not to have a threshold for when they, as far as like new cases in the community, and then you call school off for a week or two. She encouraged people not to do that because of the inconsistency of it. Where do you want to begin, Tom, with this conversation about back to school?
Lori, I have the pleasure of having three daughters, each of whom are parents of school age kids. Each of whom are extremely diligent in just about everything that they do, each of whom has this sense of agony, this sense of dread, but this sense of purpose, maybe this sense of prudence. They're fighting. Ultimately, this decision is going to be made by parents themselves and parents individually for their kids. This were once again... in my opinion, is when this whole thing started, is where a governor that has a sense of calm, maybe a little more openness, certainly a sense of purpose, the capacity to tell the truth, the understanding that we have to do this with eyes wide open. Once again, this is a real test of leadership. In a very, very difficult decision, fundamentally that will be made by parents themselves.
Hmm. Kevin Killer, your initial thoughts on back to school and some of the governor's guidance about consistency and certainty, and the importance of getting back into a classroom.
Sure, I think one of the biggest things to that I come away with. Some of that is from that is understanding that, the district that I represented previously in the legislature, half our population is under the age of 24. So basically, half of all Dakota County is under the age of 24. And, school was one of, and it still is one of the few stable environments that some of these kids had. And I think that, but also you have to, weigh in the health care concerns and the housing concerns that some of these students come from. And, if a kid comes into a classroom and there's, they somehow, there's checks, there's all kind of stuff that goes on. And then that kid somehow happens to catch COVID, and then the kid returns back to that house, most likely that kid's going to be living in an overcrowded condition and, magnifying the results. So I think, it's going to be applied differently, and hopefully, there's going to be some leeway in that policy to really give local control to each school district and to see how they can best suit their own needs. Because, looking at the way that some of this is going on, you really can't predict what's going to happen next, And And it's impossible just to kind of understand how this is going to affect, because you look at other states that have kind of shut down. You look at this state that didn't really shut down. And, you know, you're also seeing rising cases. And I think it's something that, you know, there's just different ways to look at this. And I think it's going to have to be that same kind of approach of where you're going to have to look at what school districts are doing a good job. You know, the rural areas, if there's an outbreak there. Also taking in concern of the rural healthcare needs of that rural healthcare system. And I think that's something that, you know, really needs to be thought about.
Tom, on that note, when you look at local control and these local districts making decisions that work for their communities, and many of them are taking surveys and, you know, hearing from parents and hearing from teachers, we also have this notion of equity, because there are some areas that are really going to have to shut down because of maybe healthcare capacity or something. There, you might make a very different decision at a district level if you live in Sioux Falls than if you live in a rural area, or if you live in Rapid City, or if you live in a rural tribal area. So, Tom, do we think about equity in education too down the road? Like, how is this going to affect this generation of kids, many of whom are, you know, missing out on the classroom experience and the stability that they all, you know, mostly benefit from?
Well, I mean, that's certainly the dilemma for a parent or for a policymaker is, do I escort my child into this environment so that they become educated, put them at risk, even though that risk to themselves might be minimal? I think, as Kevin said, the response is different. If you take a look at the United States, those areas that are most populated are those areas that have been most impacted by COVID. Even take a look at South Dakota. COVID equals population density for sure, and argues for a different response for different areas.
On that note, Tom, we'll start with you and then go back to Kevin here, but let's talk about that reproductive number, or that RT number, the R number that we're all watching, which is how quickly, you know, how many people are infected once somebody, you know, spreads this virus to others. I talked to Kim Olsen-Reisden, Secretary of the Department of Health, on Friday, and in Minnehaha County and Pennington County at that time, that number was greater than one, which is not what we want. What are you noticing as you keep your eye on that reproductive number and the direction that it's going?
Yeah, I mean, right now, South Dakota, not Minnehaha or Pennington County, but right now, South Dakota, according to the RT.live number, we are at a 0.94 for the state of South Dakota. That puts us in the, in the lowest seven in the country, or the best seven of the country. When you look at our per capita cases, again, we're in the lower third. When you take a look at our per capita new cases, again, we're in the lower third. South Dakota is being looked at by many as a bit of a refuge. I think the numbers in South Dakota, at this point in time, constant diligence, eyes wide open, wear your mask, for goodness sakes, distance yourself. But that notwithstanding, I think our numbers on a relative basis are good.
Let's go back to, you know, talking about state lawmakers and some of the challenges that they've sort of, you know, asked Governor Noem about her approach to checkpoints heading into reservations. Obviously, there's, you know, some legal action being taken by the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, for example. Kevin Killer, from a state lawmaker standpoint, Tribal Affairs Committee, you know, talked to Governor Noem about how this was handled. Now we're looking at Sturgis, and one of the concerns that the Attorney General had when he came on the program last week as well was, you know, people coming, as Tom said, as you know, the South Dakota is a refuge. They might be coming for you know, a rally, for example, and take one of those roads that they thought they could always take, and all of a sudden there's a checkpoint there. So speak a little bit about that relationship between that committee or those lawmakers and the governor's office when it comes to tribal relations, and then we'll talk a little bit about whether those checkpoints are working for those communities that have installed them.
Sure. So when I, when I was in office, I had the honor to serve under two governors. That was Governor Rounds, now Senator Rounds, and also Governor Dugard. And I think one of the things that stood out about Governor Dugard was that, his embrace of working with tribal communities, also Attorney General Jackley, he really approached, working with tribal communities with open arms. And I think Attorney General Ravensburg also was at the Tribal Relations Committee and took that same approach. And I think one of the things that you realize being at that level is that you play this unique role of almost being a facilitator between conversations of the needs of your community, but also a liaison to somewhat of the governor's office, the best way that you can. And of course, the governor's always going to have priorities as they see fit and as they want to kind of move conversations in different directions or different priorities and initiatives. But also, you also have to, as a legislator, you have to take into the concerns of that tribal chair you represent and be in constant communication with them. And fortunately, we didn't have this kind of issue when I was in the office. But, looking at kind of the response of Senator Foster, Representative Puyer, and looking at, they're totally supportive of the checkpoints because, as a lot of people kind of realize and as a recurring theme, and Senator Dempster also knows this as well, is that healthcare is a big issue in Native communities, and when we're looking at how to facilitate the ACA, Affordable Care Act, all over, that was a big concern of South Dakota state government, is how do we cover those costs. And I think that's something that, again, goes back to local control, making sure that these communities are able to kind of take care of themselves and understanding of this is the best way that we see it. And I've gone through the checkpoints myself. They ask you the simple questions. There's nothing, to me, I don't think there's nothing that's really invasive. And also, too, to remember is that checkpoints are set up all over, not just in South Dakota, but also New Mexico, Arizona, other states, Arizona, for example, does have another Republican governor in charge, and they're having a ridiculous outbreak on the Navajo reservation, and also Arizona has 19 different reservations, and they all are able to set up checkpoints. So I think it's just a give and take, between the communication and also the application of that. But again, those questions, they basically just ask you, have you had a temperature? Have you been around somebody who's had COVID? Just basic questions. And I think the biggest thing is just communicating that these roads aren't open. Maybe having tribal government reach out to the city of Sturgis and just saying, okay, well, if you can work with us on this, we could really kind of control this. And again, like local government, making sure that relationship's there. So.
Yeah. And I haven't checked the Sturgis website lately, but you would think most people who are coming to the event are checking in because of COVID-19, everybody's wondering what's open and what's not. So perhaps it's already, on that website. And Kevin, one of the things that Governor Noem has talked about from the beginning is hospital capacity. As we watch that hospital capacity and measure it, it's important to remember that hospital capacity is not equal throughout the state of South Dakota. If you live close to one of the urban centers, those large facilities are going to have a lot more beds than if you live in rural South Dakota, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Let's talk about another sports team, if we are ready to move on a little bit, because the Edmonton hockey team has also decided to change their name. They have agreed to change their name out of respect for the Inuit people. And Tom, let's start with you with this. The ongoing story of sports teams, it's a tough year for sports when it comes to getting together and playing, as we've seen outbreaks in Major League Baseball already after their shortened season has just started. But this is another team from Edmonton who have a long legacy saying it's time for a change. What do you make of that?
Well, I thought about that a little bit, and I don't mean to be flippant at all, but I'm going to try this and see if it works. Let's say that Tom Dempster had a real pretty face. and one day, Let's say that Tom Dempster drove through Chamberlain, and my pretty face was their mascot for their sports team. And I would object to that, and I would say, that's a taking. That's my pretty face, or that's my face. That's not anybody else's face. And they would come back with me, perhaps, and say, well, we're doing this to honor you. And I would look at I would look at them and say, well, what rights do you have to take me or take an emblem of my culture and call it your own? And particularly for Native Americans, I mean, I think that that is a taking, and there's been enough of that.
And I should correct myself. This is the Canadian Football League, Edmonton yep. team, not hockey. My apologies for that. Kevin, what happens next as teams consider changing their names? Is this part of a broader conversation? Is it? It's about time, and now it's done, and move on. How do you sort of approach the announcement of another team saying it's time to do better?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the going back to what Senator Dempster was alluding to, and also, you know, what you just said, Lori, about it's time to do better, like it's time to build better relationships, you know, and I think that's one of the things that you kind of begin to understand what Senator Dempster was talking about is that, you know, Senator Dempster might have just been driving through, you know, the Chamberlain and you know, they just have that. But there's a whole myth and a whole story about how it kind of comes to fruition. And then, and 80 years later, it's like, oh, we're the Dempsters and, you know, and this right. is who we are, and this is, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, like, what if the family of Senator Dempster said, okay, this is, you know, this isn't right. We're not benefiting from this, you know, then they turn it into some offensive ceremonies, all this kind of stuff. And it's really beginning to look at, you know, how do you rectify that relationship and move forward with the local community or that local family, in this case, Senator Dempster's. But also how do you begin to just look at those community conversations and say, okay, well, what is an appropriate conversation? And I think one of the you know, I thinking back about the Utah Utes, you know, in Utah, you know, so and their Utes, that was their mascot. And they did have, I think they did have the logo and all that kind of stuff, but eventually they realized that that it was, you know, it wasn't shedding the best light of this community. So they just changed it to just being a U. Also, they changed the mascot. I think it's the eagle now. I want to say that. But, you know, so being able just to be flexible and all that. And, you know, if you look at the case of North Dakota, I mean, North Dakota was on the verge of that, you know, where they were the Sioux and all this kind of stuff. And then they eventually had a conversation, you know, and then sometimes the NCAA has to come in and threaten things, which you don't want to get to that level. But it's just, you know, making sure that there's always, you know, you're always as a community leading forward, because, you know, I think that's one of the unique things about being in a rural area is this really unique notion of history, whether it's, you know, coming here and, you know, with your families come here, whether you're already here as a Native person, but being able to retell that, because people in urban areas, tourists from all over the world, kind of want to know that information. And the more and more that you begin to get it accurate, and the more that you'll be able to reflect that. You know, and a good example of that is Dignity, that was in Chamberlain. And it's really, you know, a lot of people stop there and they see that and they're like, okay, well, there was a conversation around that. But that's just, you know, it takes time to get there. And I think that's something that is going to take time, hopefully, for the community and the Inuit community up there in Canada to understand that this is going to be a better conversation, you know, and it's going to also lead to better relationships. And, you know, just better understanding and future conversations around community issues. So,
yeah. On that note about conversations and how we have them in a more effective and compassionate way, I think we'll close in our just remaining minute with a nod to Billy Sutton, who posted on Twitter about the death of his newborn child. And Dusty Johnson put that information in his newsletter last week with the reminder that politicians and political leaders are people too. So Billy and Kelsey, you know, suffering and have, you know, shared that information with the state. and talked about it, their daughter Lenore Antonio died just a week after being born. Time to just be compassionate and send our wishes to the Sutton family, but also to remind everybody that as we do this work in the world, whether you're a politician or a law enforcement officer or an activist or a state lawmaker or a journalist, that meanwhile life is happening to us in all these different layers and levels and dramas and heartbreaks and sorrows. And Kevin, is there anything, I know that you work closely with Billy Sutton, anything that you wanted to share with our listeners today?
I mean, just, you know, have compassion for, like you said, Lori, for all of our elected officials, people on the front lines, people who are caring about their communities, whether you're an activist, protector, whatever, you know, however you define yourself, because at the end of the day, we're all dealing with COVID, and it's really magnifying a lot of these things going on. And also just being able to be open to conversation, you know, and I think that's the thing that I appreciate about Senator Dempster, because he brought me in on this, and he's from the other party, but at the end of the day, we know that we're working for a better South Dakota while we're in the legislature, but also being able to just kind of bring that home, because at the end of the day, we're all neighbors, and making sure that we watch out for each other, and we just take care of each other, and we just check on each other.
Yeah. Tom, any final thoughts before we say farewell for today?
Yeah. Kevin, that's so kind and so gracious of you. Thank you.
Tom Dempster and Kevin Killer for today's Dakota Political Junkies. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you, Kevin, for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Tom, thank you as well. We'll see you both next time.
Indeed.